Okay.
All right, so we're looking at the Family Abbey and Bible Prophecy. We're talking about the doctrine of design and providential government. And I was talking about if I were an atheist and I didn't believe in God and I didn't believe in Jesus, I believed that Jesus never happened. I would say that Jesus was just a mythical person. I would say that the Bible is just stories, beneficial, helpful stories, but still just stories. And if I were to, so what does that do? That takes away religion, doesn't it? Takes away religion. And I'm an atheist. I still have to live my life. Now, how would I live my life? Well, I would get up in the morning, and I would realize that the sun comes up in the morning, and it sets in the evening. There's nothing that's changed. The earth is still here, the sun is still here, the stars are still here, and the people are still here. And I find that I'm hungry, and I find that I have to work in order to sustain myself, and I have to interact with nature in order to take what nature will provide to me, and I have to apply myself intellectually and physically, and if I can use the word spiritually, spiritual in the sense that I have to devote myself to the task of providing for myself. But I find myself being lonely as well. I like the company of other human beings. And I find myself with the desires that are associated with reproduction, and I discover the woman. So we find there that through the biological processes of nature itself, I discover the necessity of the family, of the company of the woman, and the offspring that come from that union. And then I discover that I age, and then I weaken over time. And I begin to realize that not only do I need the company of the woman in my youth, now I need the company of my offspring as I age, because I find that I'm not able to do as well as I get older. And then I reach a point where I may be completely dependent upon them for my sustenance. Now, there are some atheists that will say, well, when you reach a certain point, when I reach a certain point, I'll just commit suicide. That's a noble act, so I'm not a burden on anyone. I'll just commit suicide. But that's a very small percentage of people, including the atheists, because if you discover something about life, it has its downside, but it also has its upside. And it can be very happy and fun to be living. And so that even when you get old and you find there were more downsides than upsides, you still find those upsides keeping you interested in life and you want to keep going. And so you kind of like to have some help along the way. Well, right now, well, I have just described that little simple scenario. I have described the necessity for the family abbey, because the abbeys fulfill this larger context of human need that we were discussing earlier under point number one of the spiritual and the economic and the social needs of the human being. So now we have a situation that whether you believe in God or not, the very fact of design, the doctrine of design. I don't need to prove to you the need for the family or the family abbey from the Bible. I don't have to find anybody's sacred writings like the Quran or the Bible or any other book to justify or to explain or support my point of view here. Because we find that this is inherent in our beings as human beings. And I might say that explains why when you go to the opening page of the Family Abbey's website, it is so inclusive, and why I've set this up as an inclusive, movement or concept. And we don't need to base this on religion, and we don't need to base this on a political party, certainly not. This is a part of our human condition, and it crosses all religions and all kinds of people, Now that we say that abbeys are natural to the human condition, from the Christian point of view, I believe that Christianity as a religion does the best job in promoting this idea of the family, of the whole and complete family. But the fact that you don't want to embrace Christianity doesn't offend me. Because one way or the other, in your spiritual journey, you'll come to the crossroads where you realize that you need to connect to God. And that will happen independent of whatever influence I may have on your life. So I will approach this from a Christian point of view, but the fact that others do not does not offend me. So that leads me to my point. Okay, if this is the doctrine of design, and if God providentially blesses families, we find that this is where mankind finds its most wholesome experience and expression, then why is it there could ever be a conspiracy to defeat this divine plan for creation? I believe, from observation, that there is a strong influence out there to get away from the family. Even when the people declare support for the family, they're trying to get away from the family. Now think about this for a little bit. Think about all the human needs that are out there now. Look at the espressos that you find by the roadside. Who needs a wife to make you coffee in the morning when you can stop at the espresso and spend $6 for something better than what she might make? Or the wife says, why does a woman have to get up in the morning to take care of this old geezer? And I can go to work and I can get my espresso for $5 or $6 as I'm driving on to work. I don't need to fix breakfast. It can come to me as I'm on my way to work. So the simple needs of life, how many human needs are being fulfilled outside of the home now? Think about it now. You can go through quite a litany, couldn't you? By the way, I was listening to an economic commentator on the radio the other day and said that person that's spending that money on an espresso every day, coffee, was squirreling that way in the bank, they would be a millionaire by the end of their adult life. They were putting it in the bank and drawing interest or on an investment. So that little temporary luxury might be leading to your poverty someday. Even though you can afford it now, can you afford it later? What I'm saying is can you afford not to have the family? When the wife can make you that cup of coffee for 50 cents that costs you $5 or $6 at the espresso, can you afford not to have a family? And we can talk about something simple like that, but we can talk about more complex things. What about insurance? Well, now here's a thought. Once upon a time, families were big enough, family groups were big enough, that you could have your own insurance companies. They're not now. We're not big enough now to have our own insurance companies. But what if a family could be big enough? We had our own investment firm. We had our own insurance company. Maybe even our own bank. Our own family bank. What a concept. Why should these be things that we go outsourcing for? Think about the doctors. The doctrine that goes on today. I think about the insurance that I have to pay that supports the people that have to get a doctor for every little thing that goes wrong with them. When just a little herbal capsule or a little common sense would solve the problem that they have. But I'm paying insurance premiums that support that lifestyle, you see. So can I afford not to have a family, Abby? Well, when you look at the big economic picture, there are a lot of things out there that are trying, they're conspiring to defeat this reliance on the family. And I ask myself, if the family is the most natural venue for the living out of our existence, why is it that we find in our society today so much effort to outsource from the family for everything we need? Religion, worship, outsourcing that. Who needs a dad when I can go to church? Who needs a father for a spiritual leader when I have a pastor? I think that when we look at the idea of Satanism, whether you believe in a personal devil or not, a supernatural being or not, somehow along the line, at some point, the human race came in contact with either another species or some superhuman species of some kind, came into contact with a being or beings that believed that actually had malevolent intent. They were either jealous of our species, or our species was simply in the way and they wanted to destroy our species. And the best way that you could destroy a species is by getting it to not reproduce. Now, you know, most of your pesticides attack the pests that eat our plants, our crops. They attack the plant, the pests, not by killing the pest, but by attacking its reproductive abilities so that that pest cannot reproduce itself and thereby destroy your crop. Now, if I were a being like a supernatural being like Satan, and I either despised the human race, because I thought it was a crappy job of creation by the Creator, or if it was in my way of my own interests and plans, how would I eliminate that species? Well, I would try to interject any way possible things that would interrupt or destroy that species' ability to reproduce itself. I could interject an economic system that would give people economic incentive not to reproduce. I could get them interested in pleasure and to find and disdain the labor that's involved in bringing children into the world. I would encourage contraceptives. I would encourage abortion. I would encourage religions that said that it was a higher spirituality not to be married. The religion that I would teach you that sex was bad, and that that all of that stuff is non-spiritual. Then maybe I could get the best people, the one that wanted to please God the most, I would get them to not reproduce themselves. And eventually, if I can get enough wars, people fighting wars, and if I can get them to neuter themselves by forgetting what it is to be manly and forgetting what it is to be womanly, and if I can get them to eat bad food because it's easier to make and that you don't have to spend so much time, you just pop it into the microwave because it's so convenient. And you don't have to go through the trouble of making good food to eat, then food could take away the nutrition, could add poisons to your body, and therefore it would attack your reproductive system so that you wouldn't be able to reproduce. Statistically, right now, males are in this country shouldn't be able to reproduce themselves because there is so much estrogen that's being pumped into their bodies through plastics. Everything comes through plastic. Everything, pop it in the microwave, it's plastic. Everything, It's been cooked, it's been put into plastic. Processed foods is put into plastic. There's a lot of estrogen out there because of plastics. Even the milk that you get has high estrogen content in it. It's a wonder that any male is able to reproduce in our society today because of the high estrogen levels, the hormone levels. So we get, I think, that there could be a conspiracy out there to try to destroy the human species, finding substitutes for the family, and trying to destroy our reproductive abilities. So that leads me to this question here, this idea of the Mahuzim religion. It would be well to just kind of explore a few verses in the Bible that might talk about this sort of thing. Would you adjust that for me? If I look in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 in the Bible, there's a scripture in one of Paul's writings. He talks about the son of perdition. He doesn't really talk much about the devil, but he talks about this son of perdition. He says, "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." So this sounds like a pretty bad guy, doesn't it, we're reading about here. And then Paul talks a little bit more about this guy. He says in verse 7, "For the mystery of iniquity," and of course the word there in the text is lawlessness, "doth already work. Only he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. And then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. Even him who's coming after the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved." So there's some pretty strong words here. The Apostle Paul is talking about a man of lawlessness out there, and he says there's this mystery or this spirit of lawlessness that already exists. And apparently, the son of perdition sets himself up to be as a rival with God. All right? So, we already established there's this mystery person that's like this. And we want to know more about him. And we go to another text in the Bible, which is in the book of Revelation. People like to quote these verses a lot. Revelation chapter 13. Talks about this idea of the beast. The beast. And a lot of commentators associate the beast with the Antichrist. I don't know if the beast is necessarily a person. Some people have different interpretations of what the beast is. But there, this beast that he talks about here bears a lot of resemblance to this son of perdition that Paul talked about. And he goes against God. He says, it says here in verse 6, "And he opened his mouth in blasphemy," this is Revelation chapter 13, "blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him." So here we've got the same kind of guy here being worshipped. And then in the final verses of this chapter, he talks about, of course, the mark of the beast. It's worthwhile to read that again. says he calls with all small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Now, a lot of people have different theories about all of this, but the thing that sticks out in my mind is, all right, we can't really sort out always for sure who the bad guy is. But usually, you can figure out the bad guy, who the bad guy is, if he wants to do one of two things. If he wants to set himself as up as God, all right, we take him down, all right? Another thing he wants to do is he wants to control all economic transactions that occur. You can't buy or sell unless you've got his permission. And you get his permission, you get his special mark or his number that he wants you to have, and then you can carry on in commerce. But if you don't have it, you can't engage in commerce. So it's the desire for economic control. Total control over the economic exchanges of the human race is what this beast or this man or son of perdition wants to have. And lest a person doesn't have, can't make a connection, I'm going to help you a little bit here. We're really close to that now. I don't know of anybody out there that says, I'm God. I know some people out there that says, everybody's God. I don't know if that counts yet or not, but there's nobody out there that sets himself up as God that I can identify yet. But there sure are people out there that want to control all the economic exchanges that go on. They want to be able to control that. And we've got a Social Security number now. And now the only way that you can get money is through the banks, and you can't have any dealings with the banks unless you have a Social Security number. So what does that tell you? I've been doing some correspondence with our State Attorney General's office, and he says that, you know, he can't really do anything about this problem of the IRS requiring Social Security numbers for your children. Yeah. They say that the IRS won't give you tax deductions unless you have Social Security numbers for your children. So I've been in correspondence. There's been this is affecting many people across the country today who decided not to have Social Security numbers for their children. They're having to pay thousands of dollars in unnecessary taxes because the IRS requires those numbers before you can file your tax return. Yes.
I'm just amazed that you mentioned this because just yesterday, my ex-wife told me, she said, oh, by the way, our children also have social insurance numbers. And I said, how do they get those? I didn't get one until I was 14 and only because my father forced me to. So without my consent or knowledge, my children now have these numbers.
Right. Well, we can, you know, talk
in Canada. So now yeah, it's the same across the border.
It's the same down here too, and a lot of times, if you have your baby at the hospital, they just give them one with your birth certificate at the hospital. So you don't even have to. I don't suppose you even have to sign for it. You can get the child gets a Social Security number, and they look upon it as the birthright of the child. Because as a citizen of your country, they're entitled to all the benefits and privileges of citizenship, and that can't be accessed unless they have their social security number. So, you know, our society is setting up a scenario here where people have to make a decision as to where can we draw the line. Now, we can still engage in commercial transactions. We just can't use the currency. Or if we use the currency, it's very limited. So, yes.
James.
Question.
Yeah, we have children that don't have their numbers. And we were with our oldest boy. He wanted to be able to bank. And so I said, well, he doesn't have a Social Security number, but he doesn't
functions through us slaves.
Yeah, the comment is made for the benefit of the people listening to the tape, and that is that the to a limited extent, if a person with a social security number has an account with a bank, a person without a number could be a co-signer on the account, so they can use the account, but there still is accountability.
He didn't feel comfortable with that even, because, you know, then that just kind of puts him out in the forefront too, so
yeah.
He just kind of functions through everybody else.
Yeah. Yes, another comment.
Speaking on that topic, bank accounts and social insurance numbers, I opened an account about 6 months ago without a social insurance number, but they wanted other information. If I hadn't had my driver's license, I wouldn't have been able to get it. And I had to get some other member of the bank to give their home address before they would open up the account.
Yeah. There are still loopholes that we can follow through now, but they sure would like to close those loopholes. They really would. Because they want to control all the economic exchanges. That's the goal, see. And that's what they want to achieve. Now, of course, what does this have to do with family abbeys? Well, in my mind, this is all the practicality involved in a family abbey, because you have cottage industries, you are in control of the means of production. So by controlling the means of production, you are able to sustain yourself with your own labor on your own land, in your own workshops. But the need of economic exchanges still exists for a number of items that you can't produce locally. So how can you access those resources unless there are other family abbeys that you are in connection with that can provide you with the other things that you can't produce? Let's say one family abbey knows how to make light bulbs, which isn't as hard as you might think it would be. And another family abbey knows how to make generators, which wouldn't be as hard as you might think it would be. And so, you know, the economic exchanges that could occur between abbeys, you could then set up an alternative economic system that way, or a shadow economic system to supplement the one that we are currently in, which you could switch over to if it reaches this point where they demand total economic control over the exchanges. What they can't or haven't or been unwilling to try to control are the economic exchanges that go along between family members. Now, with the definition of the family beginning to widen a little bit here in legal terminology to include even gay people, all right? So if they're opening up the definition of the family, we might be able to interject a bigger concept of the family that would fit into our vision of the abbey, and thereby the exchanges that would occur between abbeys would be exchanges between family members and would therefore be non-taxable, non-traceable events, you see. We might be able to get through that loophole someday, and that might be a need that we will need to address. So then, but even more, even a little closer to this idea of the Antichrist, we're talking about the Antichrist here. Let's look at 1 John chapter 2. What does this have to do with the family abbey? 1 John 2:22 says, "Who is a liar but he that denieth that Jesus is the Christ?" He is Antichrist, that denieth the Father and the Son. Antichrist wants to deny fatherhood. Antichrist wants to deny sonship. He's denying the family. That's what the Antichrist is doing. He wants to set up an alternative system. He wants to set up the state. He wants to set up institutional substitutions for what the family does. And in doing so, he gets power to himself, but the ultimate agenda is the destruction of the human race. It's a conspiracy to destroy the human race. And if you want to call that Satan's work, or whatever work you want to call it, we sure find it in the Bible. So in my mind, here's another aspect of the Antichrist system, and that is the denial of fatherhood, the denial of patriarchy. And so this idea of the Abbey, as I said earlier, comes from the word, the Aramaic word Abba, which means father. It's the place of the father, where we find the guidance and the leadership, the security and the support and the sustenance. And we're denying that the son is the successor of the father. This is another thing that the state has attacked. Communist Manifesto attacks the family through inheritance taxes. And the state attacks the successor of the father in the Social Security system. You don't need sons anymore because the Social Security will take care of you in your old age. And so you get this whole system of denying fatherhood and denying the succession of sonship. You're breaking up the family. All of these things is the work of the Antichrist. Now let's look at religion. Daniel chapter 11, verse 36 through 39. Let's talk more about this Mahuism heresy. I'm sorry here. We didn't reference this very much yet, but we will quickly in just a moment. How am I doing on time? Is it 11:30? 11:49. Yeah, you can point that.
It won't pick that up.
Yeah, it won't pick that up. Okay. I said that Isaac Newton came up with this word called Mahuism when he was doing a study on the book of Daniel. And the book of Daniel, if I can find the book of Daniel, comes after Ezekiel, right? Here we go. Daniel chapter 11. He gets it from this whole chapter is kind of talking about what a lot of people think is the Antichrist. And I don't want to get into the particulars of the interpretation, because I really don't care if there was an Antichrist, there's one now, or if there's one in the future. All that I care about is if anybody comes along and teaches the doctrine of the Antichrist, to me, he's the Antichrist. And I don't care if he has a 666 on him or not. Comment.
Yeah. The definition, anyway, as far as I understood, was that that he gave the mark through the beast. And that mark, when you look it up in old Paleo-Hebrew and Hebrew words and Greek words, meant coinage.
Oh, okay, good. All right.
So therefore, he took the mark to be able to deal in commerce with coinage.
Okay.
That's the Antichrist. That's whoever fulfills the position of controlling that.
Okay.
Is Antichrist.
Okay.
Regardless of whether it is that man or the state, it is all Antichrist.
Okay. That's a good comment. And I might interject this also. You said coinage. The word image also comes from engraving. And, of course, in those days and still today, we engrave images on our coins. All right. And, of course, we know that Jesus identified Caesar's coins by his superscription or engraving that was on the coin, and he said, give it back to him, which was actually a backdoor way of saying, don't use Caesar's money, okay? When the Jews started to make their own coinage in 66 or 64 AD, thereabouts, that is what precipitated the Roman action. There were two things that precipitated the war to destroy the temple at that time. And that was That was that they stopped offering sacrifices on behalf of the Romans in the temple, and they started coining their own money. And that precipitated action from the Romans to invade Palestine. That was the last straw, you might say, in terms of the Jewish rebellion against the Romans at that time, was when they came up with their own coinage and stopped offering sacrifices on behalf of the state. Yeah.
Our parallel today would be when Saddam Hussein said they would go back on the gold standard and make their own coinage.
Yes, that some people,
and right. The war ensued.
That's right. There are a lot of people that believe that because one Arab nation decided, actually they're not Arab, they're just a Muslim nation, but they decided not to go with the world currency at the time, which is right now the U.S. dollar, that precipitated the Iraqi war. That's right. Yeah. And so it's a serious business. Presidents have been assassinated because they have elected to follow a different coinage.
Wasn't that Garfield?
Garfield wanted to do that. Possibly. Kennedy. Kennedy did the
Abraham
same thing.
Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln. That's right. Lincoln's greenbacks and President Kennedy's treasury notes were all.
And those notes were going to be given without interest to the people.
That's right. Given without interest to the people. Which
bypassed the bankers.
The Babylonian system of usury. That's right. So it's all connected, isn't it? Yeah.
The word coin in English is interesting. It comes from an older word, koin, or coin, which referred to striking off a small corner of a bar, and that would be used for doing an assay to determine the purity of the silver. That bit that was struck off the edge became known as a coin.
Comment on that is that in the colonial days of the Americas, currency was used also in coins, but also in silver spoons, which were cut off for its value.
That's right. Back in the ancient times, the gods were made out of gold and silver, and if you whacked off a piece of the god and stamped it, you could have a piece of the god with you.
Okay, now
in the coins.
Okay, yeah. That's good. I'd like to draw some more connections here, draw a wider web.
Okay.
This word coin comes from this word to strike off a bit of silver. Now, the Hebrew word pilyegesh is translated into English as concubine, but it also means to strike or to strike off. But you can see the word coin, or if you see the earlier form of the word coin, you can see how it's related to the word queen, which is also tied in with the Greek word gune. If you see how they transform, which links the Hebrew word to the Greek word. So our very word for queen comes from this ancient Hebrew word for concubine. So our word coin is the common element there, which ties them together.
Okay, which could be why the Babylonian system is associated with harlotry. And you can find a lot of connections there. That's very interesting. We'll have to follow up on that.
So can you honestly say that banks are whores?
Well, read the book of Revelation, especially chapter 16, I think, describes the commercial system of Babylon.
When you go outside and labor not for Zion but for money, you were laboring for Babylon, which was a whoring. That was the idol or the god that they went after. And that's why there was the problem between them and the rest of Israel, who was supposedly keeping the law, but eventually both groups went and eventually ended up following Babylon and their ways. And that was the thing. The wife that had left, the religion, had left the truth, or had left the gospel, so to speak,
right,
and went out whoring. And then what does it say in the scripture? Simply that the husband would still love the bride, but she had to come back in righteousness and want to be a part of his system again, which would be all patriarchal, Abby, and family, rather than to the world for the good. Because the example was when the prophet Hosea took, he was told to go up and show the example of what that was. And it's a very interesting story.
So then anyway, we can see then how these are all connected, these different aspects of the Antichrist system. And it's good that you're all tracking with me here on this, that you're not hung up on the idea that we're looking for a particular person, but that we're identifying the person with these moral criteria here that we're looking at here. Because it's the lawlessness that we're seeing. We have to stand for the law of God against the lawlessness. And that's how we're able to make the difference.
As I was going to say, since we are a symbol of something, and we think in symbols, that's what we look for, is a symbol.
As a symbol of something, that's right. So then anyway, what we're seeing in Daniel then, this 36 through 39, he says, "And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done." So, of course, we read something like that again earlier, didn't we, in Paul's writing. So then Daniel goes on to say, "Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers," all right, he's dismissing the patriarchy, yeah, "nor the desire of women," all right, what do you want women for? Okay? You don't need women. See, this is, he doesn't desire women, "nor regard for any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the god of forces." Now this is where the word mahuzim comes from, is this word forces. He has regard for the god of forces or fortresses, right? The god of fortresses, "and a god whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things," 39, "and he shall do in the most, and thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and he shall divide the land for grain." This man, whoever he is, in Sir Isaac Newton's mind, this was militarism. And a society that's patterned after the military structure. The God of fortresses, the Antichrist, would be not familial, the God of patriarchs, but he would be a militarist. He would rely upon the army to accomplish his goal. And he would organize all labor, whether it would be farms, he would organize it according to gang labor. Gang labor to mine in the mines and to harvest the fields and to do anything in society, everything would be big and everything would be organized according to a pecking order, and everybody would have rank in their respective corporations, and that would be how society would be set up economically. And there were actually ancient civilizations like the Spartans, for example, they would set their whole society up, their, even their family life was set up like this pyramid structure. Thank you, Josiah. So we have a God of fortresses, and so therefore we have an Antichrist to Jesus Christ. We have a pyramid structure as opposed to the Trinitarian or family type structure of the Trinity. And so then you follow down the line there, the Mahuzim religion promotes institutions where you compartmentalize all social needs and you meet it according to this so-called free market economic system. You substitute this as institutions for families. You create an urban society as opposed to an agrarian society, because whenever you involve yourself in gang labor, you have to get the gang together, don't you? And you have to march the gang out together. So that's why you have to have an urban society as opposed to an agrarian or rural society. In Mahuzim religion, economic success is based upon war and plunder, whereas in the father religion, labor is where you increase and fulfill human needs. And of course, how this is expressed in other ways. For instance, the Mahuism religion, you have the monastery. The church was set up this way in this pyramid-type structure, and the monastery substitutes the cloister as the place where the person finds their spiritual fulfillment, not in the context of the village where you have true relationships with other people. And then, of course, in how it's expressed sexually is that in the Mahuism religion, you have a homosexual culture, and a father religion, you have a heterosexual culture. You have a desire for women in the father religion, and the Mahuism religion, you don't have the desire for women. Yes?
As you said, the Mahuism religion, probably the perfect example of that has got to be the Spartans. That has got to be the perfect example. Granted, they weren't completely overcome because they still had tried to have children. But in all aspects, the Spartan culture was the Mahuism religion.
Well, the key is that you need the woman, of course, for reproduction, but you don't get emotionally attached to the woman. That's what those cultures try to teach you. You use the woman for reproduction, but you, after you accomplish that, you go back to your buddies, and that's where you have your emotional attachments, you see. And that's why in these cultures, even in the Nazi Germany, for example, they were trying to teach the German soldiers. They were trying to teach them this, although, you know, this was contrary to the German mindset, but they were trying to impose this. Nazism was trying to impose this same concept of you find your emotional fulfillment with your war buddy. Even your sexual desires are fulfilled with your war buddy, but you do have a wife because you have to perform your duty to society to reproduce, you see. And that's why you have this, they don't really look upon themselves as being homosexuals either. They don't look upon it that way. Right. They're, because they're very masculine. They're very masculine. They think homosexuals are the limp-wrist effeminate types. Of course, the Nazis persecuted those kind of guys. But the kind of guy we're talking about was not the effeminate kind. That this was, and I understand that they still, some people still are, you know, establish their pecking order in society by who's penetrating who. Okay, to put it bluntly. Okay, and so you can see where the Antichrist system goes that direction, and why in our culture today. We're drifting in that same direction quite fast. And the people that are so-called the gays today aren't the ones that are the most dangerous. Some of these, there was two Greek words for these people. You had the catamites, those are the effeminate homosexuals, and then you had the sodomites, those are the masculine homosexuals. They have wives and they have children. And they are the ones that oftentimes wield the power in society. And you would never think of themselves, had a single clue that they're homosexual. But this is part of their phallic religion that's based upon this forsaking the desire of woman and pursuing this god of fortresses. So then why is this important to the Abbey? And why is this important to the question of religion? Well, there's one more scripture I want to read before we close this section here. It's in Revelation chapter 13, verse 15. Who gives life to the beast? Who is this person in verse 15? And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Who gives power to the beast here? In verse 14, it tells us it's someone who's working miracles. Someone that's working miracles. And 13 says he's causing great wonders. In verse 12, he heals the deadly wound of the beast. In verse 11, this beast is like a lamb, not like the beast. He's like a lamb. The commentators will tell you that this is representing a false religion. And I say that it's representing religion itself. Because any time you get into religion that takes you away from the priesthood of the Father and takes you to the priesthood of another man who's not the Father, is the person that's empowering the Antichrist. And I'm saying, I'm thinking, okay, that what sustains the modern state is the modern church. And the state is the way it is because the church is the way it is. And if you want to stop the state, the economic and the control, and if you're wanting to stop this drift toward the Mahuzim religion that we're seeing in terms of the state, we're saying, oh, these are bad laws, we need to change these laws. No, what we really need to change, it's the church. It's the source of all of this. Because the state is, we're the light of the world. Isn't that what Jesus said? So if the state is doing something bad, it's because the church is doing something bad. If you're libertarian like I am in my concept, and you don't want the state, you want to eliminate the state so that you can have the family, then you have to eliminate the church. The church has to go. Because as long as the church is there, it will give life to the image of the beast. It will sustain, it will continue to sustain it. And you lop off the state and it will arise again because the church is there. It comes from the church.
Of course, what you're speaking of is something that would take generations to do.
Perhaps. Unless there's divine judgment. You always have that hanging over your head.
Yeah. But of course, as God says, there'll be 3 or 4 generations that will hate him.
Right.
And then there will be the generation that will love him.
Yes. My final point, the world after divine judgment. You can just write down these verses. We're not going to look them up, but we got Hebrews 8:11, Micah 4:4. It tells us every man will be sitting under his own fig tree, his own vine and his own fig tree. That's economic independence, isn't it? That's the independence of the family abbey. Jeremiah 33:10 tells us about the shout of the bridegroom, how in the age of God's after divine judgment, and this has been done away, we're going to hear the shout and the rejoicing of the bride and the bridegroom again. What does that mean? The family. That's what I'm saying. So it's Jeremiah 33:10, Micah 4:4, and Hebrews 8:11. All right, that's it for now. Until afternoon. Thank you for that input. That was really good.